Hallo und herzlich willkommen zurück in unserer Sonderserie Planning for Futures vom BVL Digital Podcast. Ich bin euer Host Boris Felgendreher und in dieser dritten und letzten Folge unserer Serie spreche ich mit David Thomas, der viele Jahre bei der Ford Motor Company im Supply Chain Management tätig war und die Lieferkettenplanung dort entscheidend mit beeinflusst hat. Dieses Gespräch ist auf Englisch. Danach diskutiere ich noch einmal mit Dr. Christian Grotemeyer, dem Geschäftsführer von BVL Digital, über das Segment mit David Thomas. Also alles in allem eine sehr interessante, abwechslungsreiche Episode, wie ich hoffe. Aber los geht's erstmal mit Martin Bildstein von Kinexys, den ihr hoffentlich noch aus Folge 2 und 3 in Erinnerung habt. Los geht's! Hallo Martin, willkommen zurück zum dritten und letzten Teil unserer Serie Planning for Futures, in dem sich alles um das Thema Lieferkettenplanung dreht. Wer Teil 1 und 2 noch nicht gehört hat, sollte sich auf jeden Fall die beiden Episoden nochmal anhören, denn die Folgen bauen sukzessive aufeinander auf. Heute haben wir zum Abschluss nochmal einen ganz tollen Gast geladen, der sich etliche Jahre mit dem Thema Supply Chain Planning bei der Firma Ford beschäftigt hat. Martin, kannst du uns zum Einstieg die Problematik der Lieferkettenplanung eines globalen Automobilherstellers wie Ford nochmal aus deiner Perspektive darstellen?
Das kann ich gerne tun. Aus meiner Sicht gibt es in diesen globalen Lieferketten einige Probleme. Einmal geht es darum, diese kurzfristigen, sagen wir dazu, Schocks wie und Unterbrechungen, die entstehen durch Pandemien oder durch andere Dinge, wie bringe ich die in Balance? Also wie verhindere ich, dass die einen zu großen negativen Einfluss auf mein Geschäft haben? Dann geht es darum, den herkömmlichen 30 Jahre alten monatlichen SNOP-Prozess anzupassen an die moderne Zeit, weil heute hat man nicht die Zeit, einen Monat zu warten, bis was neu geplant wird. Dann auf der anderen Seite geht es darum, halt Märkte zu entwickeln und die Anforderungen der Märkte und den Einfluss auf die Supply Chain eben besser darzustellen, also dass ich Möglichkeiten habe, Szenarien zu bilden im Vorhinein, um auf bestimmte Dinge, die in Märkten passieren, schnell und gut und richtig reagieren zu können. Dann ist da noch ein Punkt, wenn es gibt viele neue Modelle gerade, die auf den Markt kommen, gerade im Bereich der Elektrifizierung. Also wie plane ich das bestmöglich? Wie treffe ich die richtigen Entscheidungen dazu? Habe ich einen wirklichen Überblick, einen holistischen Blick auf meine gesamte Supply Chain, um hier am besten Material zu allokieren und andere Dinge zu tun? Und generell, wie kann ich es schaffen, dass ich eine einheitliche End-to-End-Sicht habe über eine globale Supply Chain, die oft noch in vielen einzelnen Regionen, Teilbereichen und Silos unterteilt ist, die manchmal jeder so ihr Süppchen für sich kochen und dadurch verhindern, dass ich einen wirklich globalen, transparenten Blick über die gesamte Supply Chain habe.
Ja, das deckt sich sehr, sehr gut mit den Erfahrungen, die David Thomas gemacht hat. Die werden wir gleich hören. Dann lass uns mal gemeinsam reinhören in das Gespräch mit David Thomas. Danach melde ich mich nochmal zu Wort, gemeinsam mit Dr. Christian Grotemeyer vom BVL Digital, um das Gehörte nochmal zu kommentieren. Martin, ich danke dir schon mal fürs Dabeisein. Ich finde es toll, dass Kinexys den BVL Digital Podcast bei dieser dreiteiligen Serie unterstützt hat. Und ich wünsche euch ein super erfolgreiches Jahr 2021.
Gerne und wünsche ich dir auch, Boris. Vielen Dank.
Super. Und hier kommt David Thomas. David, welcome to the BVL Digital Podcast. Thanks for being on the program.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
David, why don't you introduce yourself first to our audience?
Okay, my name is David Thomas. I have been retired from Ford Motor Company for just over 2 years now. I spent 38 years at Ford in a variety of positions. Yeah, seems a long time, doesn't
it? You've seen it all then, 38 years.
I've seen a lot. One of the benefits of being with a large multinational company is that you can get to see a lot of things. I mean, geographic, functional, all that kind of stuff. In fact, as I look at my career, you can sort of mathematically chunk it up. I spent roughly half of those years in kind of world headquarters, European headquarters, corporate strategy, planning, that kind of thing. And half of my career out in the field, working with dealers, working with business operations, out with plants and so on and so forth. And then similarly, and the math is also roughly correct, I spent a third in Europe. I started off in Britain,
Yes, your accent reveals it. I speak
really?
To you from the US. You're calling in from the US, but yeah. the accent is still there.
Yeah, I joined Ford from college in Britain, mm-hmm. and then spent about a third of my career working through various positions there in Ford of Britain, and then of course in Ford of Europe. So I spent about a third of my career there. Then I was moved to the US and spent a third of my career roughly in North and South America. And then I was moved to Hiroshima, Japan.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And spent about a third of my career in Hiroshima, Japan. Then I moved to Beijing in China, of course, and then moved to Shanghai. And then after that time, came back to the US and did a number of jobs in the US and ended up as Director of Global Capacity Planning, where I initiated and implemented a global planning system. But I'm sure we'll talk more about that as we
yes,
progress.
Yes, we will hone in on that for sure. But so interesting that you spent your entire professional career at one company. That's a rarity, right? It doesn't happen very often these days any longer.
No, probably not, Boris. But the good thing about, again, being in a sort of large multinational company is that you can do a whole variety of things. I mean, if I add them up, I did 24 different jobs during those 38 years. And once I'd progressed to leadership positions, I did things like I was Director of Sales and Operations Planning in Ford of Europe. I was the Advertising Director of Ford in Europe. So spent a couple of years making TV commercials.
Wow.
Okay. We actually made a hit single with Brian May from Queen to accompany one of our TV commercials, which went top 10 around Europe, interestingly enough.
What a story. You're quite the polymath then.
Yeah, it seemed it's varied. I ran the Formula One team for Ford. That's when we actually had Michael Schumacher as our driver.
Wow.
When we had the Ford Benetton team, and I ran the World Rally Championship team. And then I went to Japan, back into sales and operations planning. I ran Mazda operations outside of Japan around the world. That was when Ford owned Mazda or had a controlling stake in Mazda. That's no longer the case, of course. And then I moved to China, where I was general manager of a joint venture company there, and then moved back to the US and so on and so forth. So yes, one company, but I was able to do jobs that are really quite diverse.
Yeah, no
kidding. Interesting.
Yeah. I feel like we could probably talk for another hour just about your background and make it a whole separate episode, maybe for a future episode of the BVL Digital Podcast. But let's get back to
I'm not certain it's that interesting, but
all right, then let's jump into supply chain. That's much more interesting, maybe. Talk to me about the current, well, current is like 2 years ago you were last at supply chain and capacities at Ford, but give us just an overview of what the supply chain setup of Ford looks like these days.
Let me go back, if I may, 6 or 7 years. In fact, longer than that when you think about it. Let's go back to the Great Recession in 08, 09, a major exogenous event, self-inflicted, many would argue, but a major event for the global economy, similar in some ways to what we're unfortunately experiencing now with COVID. So Ford went through the 08, 09 Great Recession. We survived it probably by the skin of our teeth, but we came out very strong. And 2010 was a very good year. We were selling a lot of vehicles. We had tailwinds, I accept, from the fact that Ford didn't take a government bailout, whereas other auto companies in America did. So that was very helpful to the brand. But in 2011, we had more demand than we could satisfy. And we started to run into all kinds of supply chain problems, because during the Great Recession, And it's something of a surprising fact to me, in that during the Great Recession, the automotive manufacturers, the OEMs, didn't actually cut capacity, despite the fact that demand went down dramatically. In the US, it went down to from 17 to just over 10 million. But the suppliers did. So we started to run into supply chain problems, which stopped us selling. And for any company, having demand and not being able to supply that demand is a terrible feeling, obviously. So the company basically said, look, we got to go figure this out. We were going global. We were moving into global products, global finance, global purchasing. But the supply chain planning, the sales and operations planning side of it hadn't really been globalized. And because of my background, which we discussed a little earlier, because I'd worked in various parts of the world, in fact, all the major business operations of the company around the world, and in many of those positions that I ran through quickly, I'd actually been part of implementing new supply chain, sales and operations planning, business planning processes. So because I'd worked in all the major business units and had that experience, the company asked me to, well, it was a fairly short job spec. Can you go figure this out and fix it? So, fine. So I started to work on that project. And I had one basic paradigm that I worked to. Everybody talks about demand forecasting accuracy. Can you predict what's going to happen and organize your operations accordingly? But if you look at the Great Recession and look what we're going through now with COVID, so many things are unforecastable. They're exogenous events. Nobody can predict them. And they're rather catastrophic in the consequences and the impact on business performance. So as I was implementing these systems around the world, and some of these are pretty basic systems going back over the years, but my view was always, look, everybody forecasts, whether that's manual or algorithmic, everybody forecasts and everybody thinks they're good at forecasting, probably with good reason. But my view was, let's just assume that we're all equally good and equally bad at forecasting. We're all professionals in what we do. We know our companies, we know our customers, we know the economic environment in which we're operating. So we're all pretty good. It's very difficult to say whether one company is better than another one. Is Ford better than Toyota at forecasting? Is Toyota better than Ford at forecasting? Who knows? The issue to me was always, things are going to happen. Exogenous events, unforecastable supply chain disruptions are always going to happen. The issue to me is not, can you forecast the unforecastable? The issue is, who's going to sort it out the quickest? How does a company respond to inevitable disruption? Control what you can control. So that company that responds quicker than its competitors to a disruption which is industry-wide in scale is going to be more profitable, is going to recover quickly, is going to satisfy customers better than everybody else. So my view was always, look, if we can operate concurrently, if we can operate our business through digital transformation to enable us to get real-time responses to what we can see going on, then the company's going to be in a better place. So that was the kind of principle that I had behind us. Don't look at the uncontrollable. Look at what you can control and then figure out what you need to do to be able to pull the levers quicker than anybody else in those areas that you can control. Now, you won't resolve every issue, clearly, but you'll mitigate the consequences and therefore be in, relatively speaking, a better position.
And more concretely, what sort of maybe take us through the transition of what sort of planning systems, what planning approach you have then implemented it for to be in a situation as you just described?
Okay, let's just backtrack a little. Ford obviously has been, I mean, a major brand, a wonderful company, operates around the world, and has been doing so for 110 plus years. And during that period, Ford had grown up, had evolved quite regionally. We had North America clearly, with South America, Europe. We'd been in Germany for a long period of time. We had plants in Spain and Belgium and other countries. And of course, in Asia Pacific, Henry Ford himself actually set up an operation in outside Yokohama in Japan, you know, a long time ago. And our operations were very regional. North America worked one way, South America worked another way, Europe worked another way, and so on. And the business ran like that. The regional presidents were responsible for their regional operations. They had P&L responsibility. They were responsible for their plants, their suppliers, their customers, so on and so forth. That worked really well for a long time, clearly. But as the world has become more global, and as auto companies have had to move to being global, along with many other business sectors, to get the economies of scale and the utilization of CapEx and so on and so forth, there's a need to move from a regional structure to a global structure. So when I took on this assignment, Ford was still operating very regionally. So therefore, if we had a problem where a manufacturing plant in one region and the team in that region, rightly so, felt responsibility for that plant in running it, in making certain that it was efficient and so on and so forth, but that plant might supply three or four other regions, 20 or 30 other markets, multiple product lines or components. So it was very difficult where there was a problem, a disruption that impacted multiple regions, to resolve that satisfactorily in the home region to that plant, if I could put it that way. So when you had a problem at a regional plant or supplier or whatever it was, but that problem had global implications across model lines, markets, regions, it was very difficult to manage that. And I was sitting in world headquarters trying to handle a problem that had tails going throughout the operation. And first of all, no way of getting data quickly. Effectively, because of our regional evolution, we had systems that did not talk to each other. They didn't need to at the time. So we ended up having this intricate web of spreadsheets sent around by email. And obviously, as I've talked to many people in various industries, many companies have had similar challenges. Now, they were spreadsheets created by very capable colleagues who really knew their business and were really good at their job and could tell you anything about their sphere of responsibility without question. But that was their job and their region. It wasn't another region on the other side of the world with a different plant and a different operating pattern and different customers and so on and so forth. So I would have to assemble, when we had an issue, spreadsheets overnight by email from around the world, not helped, of course, by time zone differences from our offices in Shanghai and Chennai to Detroit. And it took so long to compile the data that we had very little time after compiling it to actually go figure out what we needed to do. So because of that background, what I wanted to get to was an integrated global system where the data came together seamlessly in real time so that the problem could be seen immediately. The data didn't necessarily prevent the problem, as I mentioned earlier, but you could see the problem, and then you could see the consequences of the problem as it rippled through supply chains, sales markets, vehicle line availability, plant operating patterns, and so on and so forth. So once we got the data, we were able to see the problem. Once we could see the problem, we were then able to go figure out what we needed to do about it. So that's kind of where I wanted to get to. Ford didn't have a global ERP. It had lots of sometimes aging systems that didn't talk to each other because they were never designed to do that. And they operated satisfactorily in the prior world, but they were not fit for purpose, if you like, moving into the global world where speed and data is of paramount importance in resolving issues.
And what year are we talking about when you describe these sort of separate old systems that were then replaced? What time frame are we talking?
So the project that we did was basically about 6 years. So we started off when we hit all our problems back in 2011, after we came out of the Great Recession very strongly, but then hit those supply chain problems that I mentioned earlier. So we started work in 2011, 2012. We did a year and a half of due diligence. We looked at seven major global supply chain system suppliers. Everybody will know their names. And then over those 18 months, we pared those down to a final choice, which in our case was Kinaxis and Rapid Response. Then we went into the normal, okay, let's spec out the business, let's look at the capabilities of the system. And we were very familiar with the system by that time, although clearly it was evolving almost quicker than we could adopt some of the capabilities, which is the way of technology these days, thankfully. And then we started looking to see how we could weave together five different regional operations into one global system. And clearly that was not without its challenges, but we gradually overcame them and got to where we needed to get to. But it took in total 6 years. Yeah,
but interesting that as late as 2012, you said, right, you still were working with systems that really weren't made for a modern age, right, for a modern supply chain.
Correct. Yeah. Reflecting obviously, you know, the rapid accelerating progress of technological development, sure, firstly. Sure. And secondly, the traditional way the business had been organized.
Yeah.
Now clearly that had to change. I remember when I moved from Britain to North America, there wasn't a single common vehicle between Britain and North America. If you looked at North America and South America, at the time, the products were 95% unique to South America. Different markets, different customer requirements, different this, different that, different the other. All understandable, but of course, many industries, not just automotive, have moved to get more global products with flexibility in manufacturer to get different customer variants off common platforms where the majority of the CapEx is. And things have changed, and the system needed to change as well, which is why we moved to a Kinaxis platform.
Yeah, let's get a little specific about how the system is being used and what it can do.
Okay, so obviously to try and pull together a system to help manage day-to-day operations with thousands of users around the world in different time zones and regions and languages and all those diversities, we kind of had to chunk it up. And my view was that let's build this simplistically in three chunks. Okay, The first chunk is demand. So we built the, we designed and then followed the spec we developed to build a system to enable us to pull in data and work with data across all our markets and all our product lines and all the complexities of that.
Just to understand, so this system sits on top of the existing system. It's not replacing any existing ERP systems that are being in place in different regions, but it just sits on top and pulls together data from different various systems, correct?
Yes, correct. Okay. It doesn't sit on an ERP because we didn't have a global ERP platform. We had regional systems, but they were all different. And a million spreadsheets in between, obviously. So we effectively were able to use rapid response like an ERP because it became the source of the data as well as the functionality to then manage and manipulate that data. So we didn't necessarily pull data in from one SAP system, ERP, for example. We pulled data in from, oh my goodness, I would say 30 or 40 different systems around the world, all with data interfaces and conversion tables, because all the data couldn't be added together. It was all defined differently. Ford had no global data standards at the time. So we pulled all the data in and we defined our vehicle, not just a Focus or an F-Series or a Mustang. We defined a vehicle by, obviously, the vehicle line, engine, transmission, body style, sedan or wagon, etc., transmission, emissions level, a whole series of characteristics, because that was the level where the supply chain disruptions were hurting us. We could build a vehicle, we could get the engine, but we couldn't get the transmission. We could get the transmission, we could get the engine, we could get the vehicle, but we couldn't get a super cab, we could only get a regular cab, or, you know, examples like that. So we had to go down, we didn't go down to bill of material, because the bill of material for all these products sat in PD, in a system, but we were able to pull that in where we needed to. And secondly, we didn't want to get too complicated because it would become not so much unmanageable. Anything's pretty much manageable these days, it seems to me, in terms of big data, but it would become too slow. So even with that split, vehicle, engine, transmission, body style, series, drive, and emissions, that meant that we had just over 640,000 different products around the world.
Multiplied.
As defined by those things. And that didn't go into options or colors or all that kind of stuff. So we decided on that level and we pulled demand in by each of those dimensions, by market, by region, by month, by week, by year, all that good stuff. So we had all the demand in. We could see all the demand. Then we built the capacity side. All the plants, all the lines, all the operating patterns, vehicle plants, engine plants, transmission plants, gear plants, battery plants, all those went into the system by different JPHs. By day, we had lunch times in, we had staff breaks in to all the operating patterns. We had plants with multiple lines that were fixed. We had plants with multiple lines that were flexible. The system was able to handle all that. So we built that up, populated it with the data over a period of months. So then that left us with the supply chunk bouncing off the demand chunk. And then the third and last chunk that we built was sort of all the clever stuff. It was all the rules, all the lead times, all the profit margins, all the allocation principles, all the inventory levels, all the targets, all that kind of stuff. So simplistically, we ended up with a system that had three chunks. Here's my demand, however I choose to forecast it, and with Kinaxis and Rapid Response, if you wish, you can bolt on proprietary forecasting models and all that kind of thing. But we had supply and we were able to manage the demand in light of the supply in chunk two, all the plants, all being updated daily, all showing what could and could not be built, all with the constraints in this plant can't build high roof, this plant can build high roof and low roof, this plant has got a body shop limitation, this plant has got a paint shop limitation, etc., etc. All loaded. And then we came to the algorithms, which I'll touch on in a moment. The benefit that we got of building it that way was in an organization that had difficulty getting to global totals. All the teams had all their regional stuff. They were able to operate regionally and they were expert at doing so. But pulling it together globally was always a challenge. When we'd finished building the demand side, that was usable straight away. It didn't necessarily have to have the supply side and then all the clever stuff. It was useful to us just as a design, a demand consolidator and modeling tool, if you like. So we were able to use the demand side right from the start.
Even though the real value comes when you use all the parts together concurrently, but you already getting, okay, got it. Mm-hmm.
Correct, because we spent a lot of money on this, clearly. And what we didn't want to do is have stuff sitting on the shelf that we had expended cash for to build and that we weren't getting utility out of it. And my hope, and it's I would admit it's difficult to prove, but my hope was that by the time we got all three chunks up and running, because we'd already started using chunk one and chunk two, that was helping the company optimize performance, save money, make more money, whatever it was, to the point that by the time we got chunk three and the whole system fully operation, we'd actually covered the cost of the whole system. Difficult to prove, I would accept, but we were clearly helping the company operate as we were building the system. So then we came to, you know, the clever bit, if you like. All the algorithms and all the functionalities that are built into Rapid Response that enabled us, for example, to take a problem in a plant in one region and then see how that was then going to impact other plants supplying other vehicles to other markets, and the impact then on engine plants and transmission plants and so on and so forth. And we'd always found that with a regional structure, the regions rightly felt that they owned their region because that's what they were tasked to do, clearly. But consequently, when there was a problem in their plant, commendably, they had the responsibility to help fix the problem, clearly. But they kind of also wanted to get the lion's share of the problem component when it started to become available. So that became not just time consuming to pull together, but obviously at times that became contentious, because if you have a major supply problem, that has a huge impact in the automotive industry on the profitability of a particular region or a model line or a part of the world. So we were able to build in a series of rules into the system that enabled us to flex between, okay, I can't get this engine in this plant. It's going to affect five different vehicle lines in four other regions. Now, some of those vehicle lines in those regions are more profitable than others. So what do? Do you take that shortfall and then prioritize the supply only to the profitable vehicle line in a particular region at the expense of the others or not? Well, if you want to maximize profits in the short term, well, yes, I mean, mathematically that's so. But if you restrict supply too much to other regions and models, you start to impact operating line performance in various plants. You start to run into labor issues. You start to run into quality control issues. And if you're not producing vehicles because of a shortage in one market, because all the available supplies go into another market, then you've got, how do you maintain dealer profitability? You have your distribution network to think about. So we built a lot of capabilities into the system, which enabled us to have a series of rules. And they could be as complicated as we wanted to make them, which basically said, I'm 10,000 units short of this particular component. It goes to five vehicle lines in four regions. Here's my profitability. But here's a load of other factors: importance of the particular market, strategic impact, operating plan difficulties that we're likely to have. What will it do to the dealer body? And inevitably, whenever we had situations like this, we didn't, as far as I can recall, ever allocate purely on profit, because there were too many other considerations. We had to have a balanced approach that maintained the integrity of the business where we were doing business. But we were able to fine-tune the allocations to maximize the profitability of that particular approach. So we kind of got the best of both worlds. And that's where the system, and it goes back to what I was mentioning earlier, Boris, that's where something like rapid response from Kinaxis is important, because it was performing millions upon millions upon millions of calculations to come up with recommended optimization. Not in a black box scenario. We could see how the calculations were developed. Mm-hmm. We decided not to go to black box. We had a heuristic model that enabled us to see, if you do that and calculate this, then that does that, which impacts that plan, which then impacts that vehicle, which goes through that lead time and ends up in this market with that profit level. And everything was visible. Everybody could see everything. But this was stuff that would have been impossible to do manually, which is why digital transformation is so important. We've got clever people who know their job, know the plants, know everything. But when it comes to performing millions of calculations from disparate sources around the world, all coming to a series of optimized solutions, that's not humanly possible to do based in one location.
Yeah. And interestingly, just to sum it up, I think before you had a system like this in place, you were making decisions like that, important decisions every day without knowing what kind of decisions you're making, what the impact would be, right? You were making inadvertent decisions on all of these different dimensions without fully knowing what the implications would be, right?
I would describe it this way, Boris. I mean, when we had a problem, we were able to pull data together. Was it detailed? Did it link vehicles with engines, with transmissions, with this and that? No. But we had knowledgeable staff with spreadsheets and data out of, in some cases, quite old system. So we were able to consolidate and then get a sort of high-level view of the impact and sort of what would be the most appropriate way out of it. Usually right, because the my colleagues knew their stuff. Usually right, but not optimized. What the system enables to do, because all the consolidation and the number crunching was done in the blink of an eye, we could spend our time saying, look, if we did this, here are the consequences. If we did that, here are the consequences. If we took a third route, here are the consequences. And then we spend our time making decisions on the data. We didn't spend our time consolidating the data. So really, in my view, digital transformation frees up effectively the most important resource we have. And it's not the system, it's our people. It frees them up from consolidating five different spreadsheets from five different regions every day because things change, to having all that appear on their desktop and then working with colleagues cross-functionally to make the right series of trade-offs, because everything's a trade-off. If you're short, you're short. But the system would help us manage that shortage. So rather than having, oh, gee, we had one problem, I mean, we were able to save, I don't know, $1 million. The more profitable way is to fix a million problems, even if there's only $1 margin.
Okay, yeah.
Because yep. There's always more than that. And cumulatively, that is the best way of doing it. So you have a far more holistic, encompassing, comprehensive view to managing volatility and disruption. And you can measure the bottom line. It's as simple as that.
Awesome. David, that was a fantastic deep dive. We probably spent more time than we originally anticipated, but I really appreciate your going such great length to describe your challenges and how you were able to overcome them with a system that's made for the future. So that's good stuff. I very much appreciate it. I hope your audience will too. Thanks for that really, really deep dive insight into everything. Thanks so much, David.
You're more than welcome. It's been great fun. Thanks very much.
Hallo Christian, herzlich willkommen zurück im BVL Digital Podcast, dein zweiter Auftritt. Du warst schon dabei in der ersten Folge von dieser dreiteiligen Serie. Jetzt haben wir nochmal die Chance, über das zu sprechen, was wir gerade von David Thomas gehört haben. David Thomas, ich habe gerade gemerkt, ich habe lange Zeit irgendwie so nur gelauscht und war ganz gebannt und ganz gespannt von den Geschichten, die er erzählt hat. Ein ganz besonderer Typ, dieser David Thomas.
Ja, hallo Boris, vielen Dank, dass ich wieder hier sein kann. Es hat mir auch richtig Spaß gemacht, eben David Thomas zuzuhören von Ford. Es gibt so viele Aspekte, über die wir gleich mal sprechen können, aber ich glaube, das ist eigentlich auch eine klasse Einführungsvorlesung gewesen für Masterstudenten im Supply Chain Management. Ich fand es richtig gut.
Ja, wo hast du schon jemanden, der, was hat er gesagt, 38 Jahre hat er bei Ford gearbeitet. Das fand ich alleine bemerkenswert. Das findet man heute, glaube ich, sehr, sehr selten. Und dann vielleicht auch die Tatsache, klar, wenn du in einem großen Unternehmen unterwegs bist, bist du mal in verschiedenen Regionen unterwegs, kannst du mal irgendwo reinriechen, reinschnuppern in andere Bereiche. Aber das so systematisch, ne? Dass er, was hat er, Formel 1 gemacht und Marketing und wieder dann wieder Lieferkette. Das ist natürlich mal eine super interessante Historie. Ja, lass uns eintauchen. Du bist gelernter Volkswirt, deswegen hat dich wahrscheinlich die Sequenzen oder die Kommentare bezüglich der Finanzkrise, die David, glaube ich, immer Great Depression genannt hat. Ich glaube, der meinte die Finanzkrise,
ja, genau.
2008, 2009. Was war da dein Kommentar dazu?
Ich habe jetzt nicht nachgeguckt, aber ich glaube, dass 2008, 2009 war die Zeit vom iPhone 3GS oder vielleicht war schon die Zeit vom iPhone 4. Und als er erzählt hat, wie er dort immer noch die Excel-Tabellen eingesammelt hat aus den unterschiedlichen Regionen, da habe ich mich tatsächlich gefragt, dass das so lange dauert, bis so ein großer Konzern das umstellt, auf Cloud, auf andere Reporting-Strukturen. Das hat mich wirklich gewundert. Ich glaube, die sind jetzt ja richtig, jetzt sind sie aber ganz weit vorne. Ne? Im Formel 1 würde man jetzt sagen, jetzt ist er da, hat er die Pace ganz vorne. Ja. Aber das fand ich wirklich sehr interessant. Und wie lange auch so ein Prozess dauert, sich für so eine Software zu entscheiden, das dann einzuführen. Ich meine, es ist kein Wunder. Das ist ja auch ein riesengroßes Unternehmen Ford. Allein die Produktzahl, hattest du es auch so mitbekommen? 600.000 Produkte, ne? Die muss man da auch erstmal einpflegen.
Ja.
Mit den ganzen Zulieferern, den Produktionsparametern. Ich habe mich gefragt, ist das eigentlich schon fast PPS, also Produktionsplanungssystem? Oder ist es ein reines, ja, Supply Chain Visibility Tool? Da weiß ich jetzt gar nicht genau, wie sich Kinexis dort verortet. Weil das fand ich schon sehr, sehr weitgehend. Die Dienstpläne, die Mittagspausen und so weiter, dort ja. Mit in so ein Tool einzubauen, ne?
Ja, da, ich meine, vielleicht so, was man letztlich mit rausnehmen muss, ist halt die Tatsache, dass heutzutage alle Systeme irgendwo miteinander verwoben sind, ne? Und obwohl so ein großes Unternehmen wie Ford zum Beispiel traditionellerweise mit einem großen ERP-System arbeite, ich gehe mal davon aus, dass es SAP ist zum Beispiel, heißt es nicht, dass du mit diesem einen System wirklich alle deine Probleme lösen kannst. Also du musst trotzdem noch spezialisierte Systeme haben, die dann bestimmte Aufgabenstellungen, bestimmte Problemstellungen lösen können, die dann aber wiederum mit deinen existierenden Systemen kommunizieren müssen und ineinander passen müssen, ja. Und das, selbst wenn du zum Beispiel so ein großes ERP-System hast und bist irgendwie in 30 Regionen der Welt unterwegs, dann hast du im Zweifel 30 verschiedene Versionen und Instanzen von diesem großen ERP-System und die können teilweise auch nicht untereinander kommunizieren, ja. Also das erklärt nochmal, warum das so ewig lange dauern kann, bis sich so ein großer Konzern wie Ford da bewegen kann. Und das wird den deutschen Unternehmen auch so gehen, ne? Ganz klar. David Thomas war jetzt 38 Jahre bei Ford und ich glaube, mit Fug und Recht behaupten zu können, dass in den 38 Jahren, da hat er so bitte die goldenen 38 Jahre der Automobilbranche vielleicht mitgenommen. Und ich glaube, ja, in den nächsten 5 Jahren, da kommt vielleicht mehr, 5 bis 10 Jahren kommt vielleicht mehr Veränderung, als er jemals in diesen 38 Jahren da mitgemacht hat. Deswegen ist es nur gut, dass sie inzwischen gute Systeme am Start haben, die sozusagen auf die Turbulenzen vorbereiten, die da kommen mögen in den nächsten Jahren.
Ja, ganz klar. Also er hat ja gesprochen von diesen drei Bereichen, die dieses Planungssystem dort abdeckt, das Thema Demand, Markets, Produktion und dann eben auch die unterschiedlichen Parameter, die jeweils immer festgelegt werden. Und ich glaube, da ist wirklich jetzt in den nächsten Jahren viel Bewegung drin. Auch beispielsweise, was jetzt die Produktionsabläufe angeht. Er kommt ja wirklich da, wie würde man sagen, er hat Benzin im Blut. Und ja. Das ist natürlich jetzt, wenn wir uns angucken, wie sich Automobilwirtschaft verändern wird, wie auch die Produktionsprozesse sich durch Elektro wahrscheinlich verkleinern werden. Da wird viel an diesen Parametern rumzuschrauben sein. Ja. Und da ist es gut, dass sie das jetzt, glaube ich, so vornehmen können.
Ja, da wird sich alles ändern. Von den Lieferanten, von den Zulieferern, von der Art und Weise, wie Autos hergestellt werden. Ja, welche neuen Konkurrenten auch an den Markt kommt. Also er hat ja zum Beispiel in den 38 Jahren eine Zeit mitgemacht, wo es nicht wirklich richtig neue, etablierte, interessante Player gab, die in den Markt kamen. Und jetzt stehen da eine ganze Reihe von Neubewerbern, Tesla mal ganz abgesehen, auch eine ganze Reihe an neuen Startups, die auf einmal in der Automobilbranche auftauchen, ja, die es irgendwie 30 Jahre lang nicht gegeben oder noch nie gegeben hat. Ja, also völlig neue Situation. Und da, ja, wird interessant, was da in den kommenden Jahren so passiert.
Vielleicht ist ja auch interessant nochmal zu sehen, wie, ich kann es jetzt nicht ganz genau nachzeichnen, wie die M&A-Entwicklung waren im globalen Automobilbereich. Aber viel waren ja wesentlich, wie sagte man damals, Elefantenhochzeiten, dann wieder Elefantentrennung. Ja. Das war ja das, was im Grunde genommen die Veränderung der Unternehmen ausgezeichnet hat. Mhm. Aber wie jetzt, das neue Unternehmen, chinesische, die man vor 10 Jahren noch nicht auf dem Schirm hatte, klar, Tesla wissen wir alle, aber da gibt es ja noch weitere, die da jetzt auf den Markt kommen, das hat ja vielleicht auch nochmal ganz andere Anforderungen an solche Supply Chain Systeme, weil man dann viel kleiner skaliert und nicht dieses riesengroße hat, sondern vielleicht gibt es dann Supply Chain Management auch auf dem iPhone, ne? Wer weiß, wenn das alles so klein und einfach ist.
Ja. Ja, Christian, wenn du jetzt mal so zurückblickst und wir haben jetzt gemeinsam diese 3 Episoden gehört zum Thema Planning for Future, Supply Chain Planung, bist du jetzt schlauer als vorher? Also ich habe enorm viel gelernt in diesen 3 Folgen. Das war auch das Ziel, dass wir uns ein Thema vornehmen und das mal aus verschiedenen Blickwinkeln betrachten. Ein Thema, das jetzt so super, super aktuell ist. Also hast du viel gelernt?
Ja, eine ganze Menge. Also technisch, was in solchen Systemen wie beispielsweise bei Kinexis möglich ist, das ist ja wirklich, ich weiß noch, wie ich damals eine meiner ersten Vorlesungen hatte zum Thema Logistik und wir haben lineare Optimierung gemacht. Und wenn man sich jetzt überlegt, wie komplex, was heute dort alles in diesem System gerechnet wird, das ist wirklich beeindruckend. Das ist das, was ich da jetzt mitgenommen habe. Ja. Dann natürlich auch ein bisschen die Einschätzung von David Thomas. Ja. Da ist wirklich auch viel Neues für mich dabei gewesen, die Bewertung dieser Zeit von ihm bei Ford. Und natürlich, dass wir anders planen werden. Deswegen haben wir ja auch unsere Serie so genannt, Planning for Futures.
Ja, nicht nur Future, sondern Futures, Plural, ja.
Genau. Geht nicht nur darum, für dieses eine Zielbild zu planen, sondern eigentlich immer in der Lage zu sein, für unterschiedliche Szenarien ad hoc planen zu können in Logistik und Supply Chain. Und wie das funktioniert und wie auch das jetzt in diesem Jahr gemacht wurde, was Kai Althoff in unserer ersten Episode berichtet hat aus den unterschiedlichen Industrien, da war wirklich eine ganze, ganze Menge dabei, was ich mitnehmen kann.
Ja, auch nochmal wieder das spiegeln, was Kai Althoff gesagt hatte, dass dieses Jahr nochmal wirklich so den Stellenwert der Lieferketten nochmal in die Forderung gestellt hat. Logistik und Supply Chain Management als absolute Kernfunktion, als absolut überlebensnotwendig und nicht mehr so ein Randbereich, kein Kostencenter, sondern wirklich so ein bisschen das Herzstück teilweise der meisten Unternehmen. Das hatte sowohl Martin Bilstein als auch Kai Althoff sehr, sehr eindringlich darauf hingewiesen und sehr transparent gemacht.
Das ist ja auch was, wenn ich nochmal an unsere Podcast-Serie zurückdenke, Logistik gegen Corona, in der das ja auch schon mit transparent wurde.
Ja.
Ich habe so ein bisschen jetzt gerade den Eindruck, wir konnten gut zeigen in diesem Jahr 2020, welche Funktion Logistik hat, wie Logistik funktioniert und auch immer noch funktionieren kann bei diesen Störungen. Das waren ja Störungen, die eben extern kamen. Ja. Ich habe jetzt das Gefühl, wenn ich auf 21 gucke und jetzt gerade, was so aktuell in den Nachrichten ist, jetzt wird Logistik aber richtig mit 3 Spots auf der Bühne stehen und richtig Schweißperlen im Gesicht bekommen, wenn ich jetzt an das Thema Pharma- und Impfstofflogistik denke.
Ja.
Das wird jetzt richtig, da kommt es jetzt drauf an, dass wir das eben auch schaffen und dieses Versprechen, wie hat es Karl Gernandt beim Deutschen Logistikkongress gesagt, in jedem Land gibt es Coca-Cola und wir sorgen dafür, dass der Impfstoff auch in jedem Land ist, dass das auch zügig umgesetzt wird und dass wir nicht in einem halben Jahr über Lieferschwierigkeiten und Probleme in Lieferketten sprechen, sondern wie man das geschafft hat. Mhm. Da würde ich mich sehr drauf freuen, das mit dir dann nochmal zu besprechen.
Ja, Coca-Cola muss nicht bei minus 70 Grad gelagert werden. Das macht das also um einiges einfacher. Nee, das ist ein wirklich gutes Thema. Ich glaube, da sollten wir nochmal drauf eingehen. Aber das war heute, glaube ich, schon mal. Ich hoffe, unseren Zuhörern hat es auch gefallen, ein Thema uns mal vorzunehmen, aus 3 verschiedenen Blickwinkeln zu betrachten. Dank nochmal ganz herzlich der Firma Kinexus, die das Ganze unterstützt haben. Ich hoffe, es war ein rundes Programm und die Leute, unsere Zuhörer, haben einiges gelernt heute. Dann sind wir einen Schritt weiter. Christian, vielen Dank nochmal, dass du dabei warst. Hoffentlich demnächst öfter nochmal.
Sehr gerne, Boris. Hab mich sehr gefreut, jetzt mal in dieser Konstellation mit dir zu sprechen.
Hervorragend. Christian, bis zum nächsten Mal. Bis dann.
Bis dann, Boris.
So, das war die 3. und letzte Folge unserer 3-teiligen Sonderserie zum Thema Planning for Futures vom BVL Digital Podcast. Ich hoffe, euch hat's gefallen. Vielen Dank an dieser Stelle an alle Gäste und an die Firma Kinexus für die tolle Unterstützung. Denkt dran, am 29. Januar 2021 findet noch ein Webinar zum Thema Planning for Future statt. Infos gibt's auf der Webseite unter www.planningforfutures.de und in den Shownotes. Ich verabschiede mich von euch und ich hoffe, wir hören uns bald mal wieder. In diesem Sinne, bis zum nächsten Mal, euer Boris Felgendreher.